وقوله الحق. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. وكذلك جعلناكم أمة وسطا لتكونوا شهداء على الناس. صدق الله العلي العظيم. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. A discussion on social justice has been our ongoing topic. Tonight is lecture number 8. As we tread along in this Ashra and we move now towards the weekend of Ashura, the attempt has been made since day number 1 now. It's been a week now that all of you have been very patient with me in trying to understand this massive topic of social justice in light of what's happening around the world. From the incident of George Floyd to the innocent lives in Yemen to the walking out of the NBA players yesterday, all of these various things are now telling us that we need to have this conversation. The first thing that we started to talk about is collectivism, that social justice will not make any sense to us. We can't even scratch the surface without us understanding that we belong to a social fabric, a collective, harmonized, interdependent system of not only fellow human beings, but every other creation in this universe. We then, of course, talked about evil and the necessity of evil, and, of course, why Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala cannot do dhulm. And we ended off now coming up with a logical understanding that dhulm and injustice, if it's seen and done and visible in this world, it's caused by the human being. That, of course, led to a subtopic within this massive topic of individual justice. And the only purpose of mine in the past 3 nights was to understand that in order for us to understand certain realities outside of us, they must be practiced within us. They must now show up and they must be kind of, absorbed in our spirituality. That until and unless we're able to give Allah his haqq and those around us their haqq, Allah his right, and those around us their rights, we won't be able to feel the pain of the other people who are stripped of their rights. And thus, for the past 3 nights now, we touched upon some very sensitive topics that caused a lot of feedback in the community about being just to ourselves, being just to our children, being just to our women. All in an attempt for us to understand that while we are trying to perfect our worship to Allah and give Him His due right, we're also trying to perfect those around us and give them their rights. Our children have every right to live a life as a human being. Our wives have every right to be seen as a human being, not just be lowered or just be limited to someone's sister or someone's daughter, or someone's wife, or someone's mother. No, she's a servant of God. And if we as husbands can help her, assist her, just like she assists us in trying to reach that level of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then we've helped in the process of giving her her due. If these things can at least begin to happen, it's not an independent system where, okay, I have to make sure that my kids are perfect, my wife is perfect, and then I can worry about everything else. No, they're parallel movements. But the social entity will make a lot more sense, it'll be far more effective, and will truly begin to now feel the pain and empathize with those around us when we begin now to do justice with those who are close to us. So my purpose for the past 3 nights was not to ruffle feathers, was not to upset anybody, was not to, cause any issues inside the homes. And hopefully last night, the husbands, slept in their beds and not on the couches, hopefully. But regardless, it's important that we have that discussion. We're going to leave that discussion on individual justice and move towards another subtopic of ours today and tomorrow. And that is the barriers of justice. Sometimes, and I have a little bit more to say in my muqaddimah tonight than I do usually, And it is an Avim night for Masa'ib. And my heart is already breaking that I am, you know, this is the night of Abul Fazl Abbas, and literally not a single soul is sitting in front of me. And it's been a very, very difficult time for me to recite Masa'ib without individuals crying with me. But I know that wherever you are listening to me from, the tears that you have are inside your heart. And wherever your heart is with you, the tears will follow. Khair. Sometimes we know what we need to do. We have the knowledge. Everything I've been saying for the past two or three nights is nothing new. They're just reminders for me as an individual, as a father, as a husband. And sometimes the issue isn't knowing. It's important to know, right? I mean, you heal a wound when you recognize that there's a wound there to begin with. The pain sometimes that our women feel in our communities, in our homes, is that Malana, forget healing the wound. I don't think the people around me even understand that I'm wounded. First acknowledge the wound, and then, of course, we talk about healing and treatment. So, you know, sometimes we understand there's a problem. But the bridge from understanding there's a problem to fixing the problem is sometimes miles and miles long. If I was to ask myself, what are my deficiencies? Ooh, I have a long list, and I know myself. And that's part of the reason why when someone else tells me my deficiencies, I get upset. I get upset because I know, don't tell me, I know, don't tell me, I know. I don't want to hear it. I don't want someone else now to confirm what I already know about myself. So knowing the deficiency isn't the problem. Fixing it is difficult. Knowing I have to change is not sometimes hard. Changing is difficult. Knowing that I need to be more just to those around me and those outside of me. Knowing that I need to worry about and be sympathetic towards and at least have acknowledgement of the fact of my children and my wife and myself, let alone the people in Yemen, in Palestine, Iraq, in Syria, Pakistan, China, and everywhere else, and of course in North America with the African American community. I understand all of that. I do. The problem is in execution. The problem is conversion of what I know to what I do. Ilm to amal. In terms of writing it, alif, lam, meem, it's easy. Just swap the lam and the meem and you're good. But on the ground, man, it's hard. It's hard. And that's why sometimes, you know, the ulama of akhlaq, they talk about the fact that even the intellect can have an excessive amount inside of its own department. We have a faculty called the faculty of the intellect inside of us, the faculty of the intellect inside of us. That faculty should be there, and we should strengthen it enough to be able to now, of course, guide, train, and govern over the other various powers that exist. My anger, my desire, etc., etc. That's, you know, akhlaq and morality 101. But even the intellect can have an excessive amount to it. What happens when we have an excessive amount of the aql and the intellect? That knowledge that we have becomes a veil. Becomes a veil. It's a point I've made in a different set of majalis I'm reciting somewhere else in these first 10 days. I just want to make it very, very quickly here. Because, you know, it's important that I set the ground tonight for the next two nights. We've been, you know, if you were to describe to an outsider this entire system of azadari that we have, okay? That what do you guys do for 2 months of Muharram and Safar as a Shia nation? What have you been doing for all these centuries? And you describe to them that, look, in these programs, we recall through our poetry and through our marsiyas and through our salams and everything like that, we recall the tragedy of the events of Karbala. Okay. We also then have a lecture. In that lecture, right, the scholar now talks about things like piety, talks about things like the Quran, talks about things like lessons from history, talks about hope, forgiveness, mercy, love for your family, right, forgiving yourself, the distinction of the family of the Prophet, the stories of the prophets beforehand, just to learn so we can learn lessons from those previous stories, right? All of it should be self-building through various avenues, history, through fada'il, through the Quran. All of it essentially is to become better human beings. And you've been doing this for centuries? Yes, we have. She would think, he would think, as an outsider, wow, you guys must be at a very high level in terms of your families and your communities and your spirituality individually. I mean, you really must be a flourishing community in terms of your domestic family issues. And the reality is that we're not. Like, we're not where we should be. The treasure that we have as Shias, the knowledge that has been left behind in the form of treasures from the Ahlul Bayt, in the form of tafsir, ahadith, dua, munajat, supplications, ziyarat, their own stories of akhlaq, their own sunnat, there is a treasure that I dare say no other sect of Islam, no other religion has, that we the Shias have. And yet, we should be better. Our homes shouldn't be burning. Our divorces shouldn't be skyrocketing. Our youth shouldn't be on the brink of atheism. Our centers shouldn't be dividing up into, you know, pizza slices, it seems. So there's a disconnect somewhere, right? There's a disconnect. And you know, I oftentimes say this, you know, let's do a quick calculation, okay? You and I together, okay? You know, calculate for me the amount of hours of majalis that you have heard in your lifetime. Now, depending, of course, on where you are. And one of the most beautiful things that I have been shared, and so many messages, people are telling me that in this one room of ours, in our living room, in our homes, there are three different generations that are listening to me right now. My respected, beautiful elders, right? My parents, of course, my children, and my youth, and my sons and daughters. Now, all of you have your respective calculations. Some of you might say hundreds of hours, Mawlana, of majalis. Hundreds of hours of majalis of a wide range of scholars and speakers, ulama, zakirs, khatibs, you name it. Okay? Different topics. So there's not a lack of knowledge being given to us as a Shia nation. It's not a lack of knowledge. What it seems to me, maybe I'm wrong, is a lack of what? Conversion of that knowledge into action. As Ayatollah Bahajat Rahmatullah Alayhi says, one of the biggest and the most highest urafa of our time, in a very famous statement before he passes away, if the Ummah of Islam only acted on what they knew, we would be somewhere else right now. And so, it's not a lack of knowing, it's a lack of doing. And that's why when I got messages through my family, me directly, that message 2 nights ago about respecting your children, and I got messages that night of fathers messaging me or children coming to me and saying that my mother, my father, after 30, 40 years, called me to apologize. My heart broke, shattered into pieces. And that's what I mean by hearing something Islamic now and then applying it right away. And instantly now there's a sense of just relief, a sense of itminan, a sense of serenity. So it's just not enough to know, and an excessive amount of the intellect is knowing to the point it becomes a veil. Now we simply think that, you know what, I know enough, and that's enough. Knowing is the entire battle. It used to go from half the battle, now it's become everything. I know. Don't teach me, don't preach to me, don't tell me, I know. And that's why one of the things that I'm concerned about when this pandemic is over, and once again, this hall, inshallah, will be full, My fear is, my concern is, that while the elders of our community will come running back to the center, because this is, you know, this is their socializing, this is where they feel like they give back, this is where they feel complete and whole and full. It's the young guys that I'm worried about. They'll sit there and say, oh, you know what? I kind of like that virtual world, say that's it. I'm sitting in my pajamas right now, in my living room, on my lazy boy, hopefully not, on the floor, comfortable with my family, beside my wife, my mom is there, my sister is there, my kids are in my lap right now. We're watching you on a beautiful TV right now, Chromecasting it. We have some snacks, we have some tabarruk. It's a beautiful, beautiful environment, right? No commute, no parking, right? No crowds, no getting my kids ready 3 hours before the actual program starts. No dealing with the shushing inside of the centers. No being shoved to a room and saying, there you go, that's your room. None of that, I'm comfortable. And yet I'm still getting the same knowledge. And thus not giving this building the respect it deserves. Remember, this building is the building and the walls where we convert what we know to what we do. This is where that is instigated. The catalyst of that conversion happens here. So please, I hope that's not the case. I hope that's not where the thought pattern is going. Anyways, so all of these three discussions we've had in the previous nights are all information. Now it comes time for us to convert it. But there's blockages, there's barriers, right? Something is not right. Something's blocking us from converting our what we know to what we do, okay? I think I've killed the point already. I want to identify two. Today one, tomorrow one. And close out the Ashra on Saturday with, of course, a discussion on our 12th Imam and social justice. All in light of what we talked about in these past 8, 9, 10 nights, okay? The first one I want to speak about tonight is the concept of me-centric individualism. Farid al-Girai, as they call it in Farsi. And the premise is, of tonight's lecture, is that if I believe that the only person that matters is me, so I'm me-centric, my life is me-centric, my decisions are me-centric, right? Everything I surround myself should kind of feed that me-centric philosophy, then I won't be able to sympathize, empathize, even identify with the pain of anyone else. I can't. I'm too busy looking at me. And there is a definite wall between me and anyone else, be it my loved ones, or be it somebody in a faraway country. Be it the ones that I care about, be it the ones that are complete strangers to me. And so when we hear about Blake getting seven bullets in his back, you know, kind of turn the page. Scroll down from our feeds. Because that doesn't affect me. Now, it's subconscious now. It's a subconscious movement towards a me-centric, individualistic society today. Okay? And we have to acknowledge it. There has to be a wound there to acknowledge. And we acknowledge the wound, and then we have to learn to heal it. Now look, one point I want to make here, and I'm sorry, I'm throwing a thousand things at you tonight, but I just have to. I know there's going to be points that I'm going to miss in these lectures. I know that last night's discussion, I could have went on for 10 more nights about that topic last night, and there were things that I missed. But in a 45 to 50 minute conversation talking about injustice on women, there's going to be things that I miss. It doesn't mean that I am, you know, I'm insensitive towards that. It means that it was my subjective call to talk about these three or four things. 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 had to be discussed. I ran out of time. And equally in this topic on individualism and a me-centric, me generation that we live in, there's bound to be things that I'm going to miss. But at least let's trigger the thought, guys. Let's plant the seed, right? Let's at least identify there is a wound here that needs to be healed. That's the first step, right? We live in an era of consumerism, correct? Everything is consumerism. It's all about consumption. It's all about the customer, the consumer, you and I. And all these major corporations have identified that the easier I make the consumer, the customer, in terms of their life to buy things, the better it is for me. So you're sitting there and you download an app, let's say at 11 o'clock at night, and you wonder, you know what, I need, for example, I don't know, I need dishwashing liquid, for example. I need a bag of cashews. And so at 11 o'clock at night, the store's closed. What do? You go on, you know, this company. If you got Prime, then you order Prime. If you don't have Prime, you ask your family or in your fam jam groups, who has Prime? I do. Give me the ID and password. Why? I need cashews tomorrow morning for some reason. Okay, no problem. Right? You go on there, you swipe. Your order has been placed. Like, whoo, that's the easiest cashews I've ever bought in my life. Consumerism, right? And not only is it that, but in the world of consumerism, the customer is godlike. Has all the power. You don't like it? 30-day money-back refund policy. No problem. I've mentioned this before. I legit was in line one day at Costco. I saw a man with a half a watermelon. A half a watermelon. True story. And I'm behind him. I'm like, oh man, I gotta hear this story, right? I just gotta hear what is he returning? And this man at the counter of Costco says that this watermelon was half sweet and half sour. I ate the sweet half. I am returning the sour part to you. And they took it. They took it. They gave half his money back. I'm like, what? I brought this plant home. I watered it. It died. I'm giving you the dead plant back. And they took it back. Customer's God, man. You're not happy? It's okay, sir. Please, come. Here's your money back. Please, just don't be upset at us. Don't give us a negative rating. Don't give us this. Don't give up. No, that's it. Okay, no problem. Sure. You can customize anything, right? Customize anything. Go to a restaurant, you know, and you know it spells out on the menu exactly what the dish has. It has this. And you know, there's always one, right? In all of our family dinners. Excuse me, can you come here? You know, these onions, can they be sun-dried tomatoes? Yeah. Can you make sure that, you know, you don't overcook them? I don't want it too spicy and a little bit less on the salt. And I just want to make sure that on the left side is my steak, on the right side are my veggies. And you're looking at them like, seriously? And the waiter goes, yes, absolutely, sir. Sure, no problem. And, you know, inside of his head, man, so long as your credit card passes and is approved, you can have whatever you want. So they're out there saying, look, make sure sun-dried tomatoes, you know, not overly burnt, not too spicy, not too salty, bam, no problem. Here you go, ma'am, no problem. It's not on our menu, but we'll customize it for you. Why? Because you're the consumer. In the world of social media, what do? We follow on Twitter, on Instagram, on Facebook, those things that subconsciously support our view, that we are now kind of drawn towards. I like that post, let me follow him. I like this tweet, let me follow them, okay? Nothing wrong with it. I need an open mind from you guys tonight, okay? Don't close me. You've been very supportive so far, and you've been very patient with me. Give me that open mind I need right now. This is a very crucial discussion, okay? We create our social media world into a utopian world where now on my timeline, in my feed, are all things that I like, that, you know, kind of, you know, reconfirm the way I think. In the process, in somewhere in this consumerism social media world, there's God. There's spirituality. There's subservience to a higher power. There's submission to something beyond me. And we're asking a lot now for an 18-year-old to not take this culture of consumerism where I am God now. you know, they have to cater to me. I'm the one who's a customer. If you don't take this half watermelon back, I'm gonna complain, throw a fit, hashtags, and that's it. And so yeah, no problem. Makes no sense to me whatsoever that you ate half the watermelon, the other half you give back, but here you go. I just want to avoid the hashtag. You're like, that's right. Give me half my money and let me go and let me go on my way. And then we start to believe that everything around me is a product and I'm the customer. And your job is to sell me that product. And if I don't like it, I'm not going to buy it. Or I'm going to customize it to fit me. And that mentality trickles into the deen of Allah. Subconsciously, I want the deen to customize to me, just like I customize that menu item for lunch. If I don't like something of the deen, I want God to take it back, give me my money back, just like I return that half-dead plant. Subconsciously now. I will only choose those things in the deen that are good for me, easy for me, I'm able to follow because I've created this utopian social media world. I want the deen also to kind of be a utopian world. In the process, what ends up happening is we go from God-centric to me-centric. We go from God being the source of our worship to me being the source of my worship. We go from submitting outside of me to submitting to me. And all sorts of emotions. Doesn't feel right. I don't want to do this. You know, and so literally the example I've given so many times is a buffet table, right? It's actually my father-in-law's example, buffet table. You pick and choose from the buffet what you want, right? Nobody picks up the asparagus from the buffet. You know, the waiter never refills the asparagus. But the French fries, for some reason, whenever I go up there, they're empty. Me-centric. And you'll tell me, oh, wait a second, Asabhai, you lost me now. We were good so far, right? 3 nights ago, you talked about self-worth, the importance of the self. Absolutely, no doubt about it. But I talked about the fact that we have to feel like we're worthy to enter God's kingdom. Please make that decision very well. I don't think I made that clear 3 nights ago. I talked about the fact of us being worthy of God's kingdom. But once we enter God's kingdom, we submit, we're subservient. We're an abd of Allah. And that abd of Allah and that idea of me being submissive towards Allah means that sometimes I have to fight the me-centric inside of me just to what? Just to conquer the God-centric inside of me. And you know, and the Quran talks about this very, very beautifully in various verses that all of you, I'm sure, have heard, but I want you to look at it through the lens that I'm talking about tonight. And that lens is, for example, Surah Ali Imran, I believe, that says, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, لَن تَنَالُوا الْبِرْ حَتَّى تُنْفِقُوا مِمَّا تُحِبُّونَ لَن تَنَالُوا الْبِرْ حَتَّى تُنْفِقُوا مِمَّا تُحِبُّونَ. A very famous verse, one that has an immense amount of lessons in it. The word in the Arabic right beneath me is bir, okay? Bir. Bir of someone who's abrar, it might be righteous. I'm not sure what the transition is right now, but it might be the idea of righteousness, okay? Bir is the opposite of bir is bahar. Bahar means the ocean, water. Bir literally means, the lexical meaning is zameen, is earth, right? What is Allah trying to say? You will never reach the point. You'll never, lan, meaning you'll never reach the point of bir, to the point where your righteousness, now what? Now spreads all over the land, meaning your akhlaq, your behavior, your morality spreads from corner to corner to corner. That's why it's called bir. It covers the zameen. It's not just between you and your family. Others are affected by your righteousness. That's a high level to reach, right? He says, you'll never get there until you give out of what you love. Now, right away, someone like me looks at that verse and says, okay, fine, I'll give you money. I'll give you, I don't know, a donation, some food, some clothing. No, sometimes what we love the most is our comfort zone. It's our comfort zone. And sometimes, literally, what the God-centric inside of me is screaming for is, look, sometimes it's not about your comfort. Sometimes, yes, Allah says to break that comfort zone to worship me. Let's be real here. One of the avenues of patience that the Prophet talks about is the fact that, yes, there's patience in hardship, there's patience fighting shaitan, there's also patience in worshiping Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Absolutely. 4 o'clock in the morning in that warm bed of yours, right? That pillow that you have, right? That pillow that you have. Like, I'm a pillow Nazi. I have a certain pillow, and that pillow goes everywhere with me. I mean, it's not here tonight, but when I travel, I mean, it goes everywhere with me. I'm a hard pillow guy. In fact, I have a certain distaste in my mouth for soft pillow people. I'm sorry. If you're a soft pillow person, you and I can't be friends. I don't understand soft pillow people. Like, I don't get it. Like, where's the support, right? I have to have a hard rock pillow, okay? And if anyone touches my pillow or uses my pillow, and if my pillow isn't there, you know, on the bed at night, then I go find it. I mean, what am I gonna do, right? I go find it. Anyways, okay? So you're in that pillow, you found the groove, that thing, you know when you just cover, people cover their ear, I cover around my ear, right? So I have the blanket around my ear, on my hard pillow, I have my angle and my arms. I'm really weird when I sleep, perfectly, oh, perfect, and then 4 o'clock, ding, 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 my alarm goes off. And I'm like, oh, man, come on, man. Oh my God, this is really comfortable right now. And the God-centric in me says, let's go. Go and splash some water on your face. Water on your face. And we use the bare minimum water because I don't want to lose my sleep. So I'm praying Fajr with the hopes that please, I want to make sure I catch my sleep again. Don't be too awake. Don't be too, because I can't go back to sleep then. So, you know, one eye is open. Allahu Akbar, please, just. لَن تَنَالُوا الْبِرَّ حَتَّى تُنْفِقُوا مِمَّا تُحِبُّونَ. Your comfort zones, right? What's difficult for you, what's easy for you, right? And in this me-centric is, everything is around me. It's all about how I feel. It's all about what's comfortable for me. It's all about what's okay for me, what's easy for me. Anything difficult for me in a me-centric era is rejected. How can you ask me to do that? I don't feel comfortable. I can't do that. I'm sorry. In a God-centric era, it goes from what? From traveling outside of you to seeing what does God want. If that means sacrifice, we sacrifice. We cry for the one who sacrifices. We celebrate the ones who sacrifice. We respect the ones who sacrifice. We have to become the ones who sacrifice. And sometimes sacrificing is our comfort zone. I don't feel comfortable wearing hijab. I don't feel comfortable giving 20% of my khums. I don't feel comfortable doing this, but God's saying to do it. So sometimes it's not always about, I'm sorry, how we feel, how I feel. It isn't. And in a me-centric society, there's a little bit too much emphasis on how I feel. Right? How I feel sometimes is jaded. How I feel sometimes is tainted. Look what the Quran says. The Quran says, وَأَنَا عَسَىٰ تَكْرُهُ شَيْءٍ وَهُوَ خَيْرٌ لَكُمْ. Very beautiful verse that I have been using everywhere I go. وَأَنَا عَسَىٰ تُحِبُّ شَيْءٍ وَهُوَ شَرٌ لَكُمْ. It could be that you despise something. That you have nafrat toward, that you don't like it. But what? وَهُوَ خَيْرٌ لَكُمْ. It's good for you. It could be that you adore something, you love something. Oh my God, it's everything to you. And the word used in the Arabic is hub. It could be that you love something, but what? It's actually detrimental for you. Allah is saying, look, it's not always about how you perceive it. Trust the way I perceive it. I know that 4 o'clock in the morning when you are buried under your blanket, it's hard to wake up and splash water on your face. I know that in at the age of 9 or 10, when you have to fast for the first time in your life in the summer in Toronto, it's not easy. I know that going to Hajj, let's say in July, in that burning sun, that desert heat, is not easy. I know. But it's always about a little bit of zahmat, a little bit of discomfort for what? For eventual gain and for elevation. Because when we begin to break the chains of the me-centric inside of me, I start to see everyone around me as avenues of my perfection, and I see myself as avenues of their perfection. One of the most beautiful things that a God-centric mentality provides is the fact that now I see every interaction, every individual, every relationship as one more, inch up the mountain of perfection. I really do. Great relationships, horrible relationships. Amazing conversations, and ones I wish I never had. Interactions that I wish I avoided, interactions I wish that would never end. All of them collectively now, all add to my perfection. That's why all those talks I had in the beginning of the Ashra, collectivism. Remember those verses I talked about? The animal in the land, the bird in the sky, and me. All of us now are working towards one. Think about it for a second. The perfection of a rock, okay? The perfection of a rock is that it becomes a gem and a jewel, right? Where is a pebble on the ocean, on the sand, and where is a diamond, right? They're both rocks, but the perfection is a diamond. The perfection of a fruit, let's say, is its sweetness. You have, let's say, for example, a bowl of grapes that are sour, and a bowl of strawberries that are really sweet. You'll try one grape, you'll say, no, thank you. You'll finish the strawberries. That's the perfection and kamal of the fruit. Every existence has a path of perfection. لِكُلِّ شَيْءٍ طَرِيقٍ, the Prophet says. Everything has a path. Everything has a path. And everything's moving towards its creator. إِنَّا لِلَّهِ وَإِنَّا إِلَيْهِ رَاجِعُونَ. For some reason, we always dedicate that one line for the dead. It's not. It's very much for you and I. When we sway off the path, we go back on the path. Our entire idea is that Allah, you created me, you put me down on this world. Now I have to somehow live in my 65, 75, 85, 110 years inshallah in this world and go back to you with somehow resembling the same perfection when I first arrived in this world. And Allah places everything around us now to say, look, I know it's hard for you now, individually, with all of your deficiencies and all of your evil and all of your weaknesses to reach my perfection. So I'm going to surround you with elements to help you reach your goal, provided you see yourself as one portion of a collective good. The only way that diamond reaches perfection is if the miner does his job, if the earth does her job. The only way that fruit becomes sweet is if the farmer does their job, if the soil does their job, if the tree holding that fruit does their job, if the rain, the sunlight, all these elements. The only way that I can reach my perfection, if those around me now help me reach my perfection, be it directly like my spouse and my children and others, or be it indirectly like someone who's wronged me. Someone who's wronged me has a role to play in my perfection. Because of them now, I'm courageous. Because of them now, I'm strong. Because of them now, I have this sense of self-respect. At that moment, we won't see it. But later on now, you look back to that moment that was detrimental for you, and you might think, you know what, I am the person I am today because of it. The Prophet of Allah went through a lot of problems in his first few years of life, from being an orphan to losing Abu Talib to being moved from here to there to being sent outside the outskirts of Mecca, all of that. And when history describes and tries to explain why that is, all of that was to prep him for what? For the weight of prophethood at the age of 40. So every collective experience, every existence had a role to play in my perfection. I can't see that if it's just about me, 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 me. I can't see it. If I replace God, even in my worship, so the form of my worship is still there, right? I mean, I'm still praying, I'm still wearing hijab, I'm still going for Hajj, but the spirit of that worship is no longer there. God is no longer in the equation. I'm now in the equation, okay? So now I'm wearing hijab. I'm praying namaz for me. I went to Hajj on the money I earned, the vacation that I was able to get approved, and the fact that I was able to arrange for someone to watch my kids while I'm gone for Hajj, okay? Guys, subconsciously, stay with me, don't lose me, subconsciously, okay? After a while now, all these acts of worship that really should be fi sabilillah, for Allah, on the path towards Allah, becomes on the path of me. The problem with that is that if you believe that I'm the one that's worshiping God, then you can easily say that I can also stop worshiping God. Okay? There are people who ask me all the time, is it okay if I take a pause from praying Salat just to find out if I am doing it properly for the right reason? You know, the example that another scholar gave that I'm going to use right now, and I'll credit him for that, and that is the fact that he talks about hijabi influencers right now online. It boggles my mind. These influencers, you know, have become influencers because of the very hijab on their head. And now that they got a little bit of status and they become influencers, the hijab no longer is needed. That hijab comes off very easily when they believe that I put on the hijab so I can take it off. It's my head, it's my choice. There's a lot of I and my in that. There's no God in that. I worship Allah, I can stop worshiping. I can, it's me. If I choose not to, that's my choice. If somebody comes and says, sister, what happened? Brother, what happened? Mind your own business. Mind your own business. It's none of your business. What I do has nothing to do with you. And that's what the me-centric danger is, that we start to believe that my own deeds don't affect anybody else. My post on Instagram doesn't affect anybody else. My post on social media doesn't affect anybody else. My actions, my words, I don't know, my anger, my screaming, my tarbiyat, my this and that doesn't affect anybody else. It's me. It's my tongue, it's my words, it's my thoughts, it's my choice to live the way I want to live. It's none of your business. When we start to see things in a God-centric lens, everyone is part of the same equation. Therefore, my actions are affected and affecting everybody else. Now, we can fight that and say, whoa, say that, son, man. That's a lot, that's very heavy on me, very heavy on me. You want me to think twice, three times, four times before I do something? Yeah, I do. Yes, I do. That's a good thing, my man. If I stop and think for a moment, wait, well, you know, if I do this, how will that affect this person, that person? It's heavy. It's a lot. I get it. But it's a blessing to have filters upon filters upon filters before you actually carry out the actions. Think twice. Think three times. In a me-centric world, there's no filter. If I think it's right, bismillah, go ahead, do it. Woo! Wait a second, we just realized that there's a lot of problems inside of me. And that's why Allah time and time again now reminds us, Ya ayyuhannas, Ya ayyuhannas, O mankind, not the mu'mineen, not the kuffar, not the munafiqeen. No, Allah says every single human being, Antum fuqara'u ilallah. Beautiful verse, man. Antum fuqara'u ilallah, wallahu ghaniyun hamid. You are somebody who's in constant need of Allah. You are a faqir in the eyes of Allah. You are a beggar in the eyes of Allah. And Allah is ghaniyun hamid. He's needless. So when we are in need, we're always in need, we can't turn inward. Because then we become the idol. Last point, and then Messiah. What ends up happening is when that worship now is stripped of God and replaced with I and me, then what happens? I go from worshiping God to worshiping myself. I become my own idol, subconsciously. I want you guys, I don't want to make enemies, but Allah, I want you guys to ask yourself a question, okay? Ask yourself, those of you who have a very active Facebook page, ask yourself how many pictures of me are on my own Facebook page, okay? How many pictures of me are on my own Facebook page, okay? You know, growing up, you know, we grew up in an apartment in Scarborough, and you know, there was four of us, our siblings, and so I would always be sharing my room with one of my brothers. And you know, we're big on sports, right? When we thought we could play, we would play, and you know, we still think we could play until you know like a few Advils and some bags of ice later, we thought, you know what, maybe watching it right now is good. Anyways, so in our room, I remember in our room in Scarborough, in apartments, we would have posters up. And on one side, there'd be posters of cars. Typical guy's room, right? Just typical guy's room. We have posters of cars. So I remember the cars, Lamborghini, Ferrari, this and that. I don't know what else. I thought maybe if I look at it, maybe, I don't know. I just liked the way that the car was, the whole thing, you know, the way the doors, whatever. On the other side of the room were posters of athletes. So I had a poster of Michael Jordan, Ken Griffey. I had a poster of, you know, it was mostly Jordan, because big Jordan fan. Mostly Jordan in my room, okay? And my room was my haven, like it is for everybody else. Our home is our haven for everybody outside. Inside of my home, my haven is my room, just like it is your room, right? Okay. I sometimes think to myself, if I ever had a room where I would walk into my haven, where I feel the most comfortable, and instead of these walls, instead of these cars and athletes and whatever on the wall, there would be, you know, every inch of the wall would be covered with pictures of myself. Myself. Look, I get a framed picture of you and your siblings or you and your husband in your room. I get that, I'm obviously, right? But just a wall of selfies, like a collage, like one of those, you know, one of those, like, you know, one of those creepy collages of just you in your room of all selfies, like 40 of them. The room would breed narcissism, egoism. And it would definitely produce somebody who would fall in love with themselves. The problem is, and there's lots of problems today, and I'm sorry. When we subconsciously end up making me the idol, and remember, this is all about injustice, right? I haven't lost my topic, okay? There's no way that we'll be able to do justice on anybody outside of me if all I see is me, okay? So no pain of anybody else will ever shake me. I won't even, like I said in the beginning, I won't even acknowledge that there's a wound there. Meanwhile, the ones that we love are draped in wounds and wounds and wounds. Right? Remember the story of Surah Mujadala last night, right? Qad sami Allah. The first thing Allah says is tell her, Ya Rasulullah, that God hears you. God hears you. That's God saying what? I know there's a wound there. Half the battle, man. I know there's a wound there. But in a me-centric world, we don't see wounds unless they're on ourselves, right? So we become the idol that we worship. We become the idol. Now, the rule of thumb in worship is that if you identify this idol or this being or this entity to worship, you do everything you can to preserve and protect that idol, correct? Why were they so angry with Nabi Ibrahim for breaking down the idols? Because they were idols. They were respected idols. Those are the source of our hajat, of our du'as. We went there for prayer, for worship, for contemplation. How can you, they will lock up the idols. Some people will sit there and put them in a very special cabinet, lock the cabinet, clean it every single day, put it on a pedestal. Idol was everything. If somebody broke the idol, it was blasphemous. That all makes sense. When you become your own idol, you do everything you can to what? To preserve yourself. To make sure that no matter what happens, I always shine. I'm always number one. I've identified this idol to be higher than me. Please follow the example and then Masaib. Higher than me, right? You only accept this entity to worship when you think this entity is higher than you. Be it Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, be it, you know, science, be it an idol, be it whatever the case may be. And when you begin now to worship yourself, you see yourself at a higher state than you actually are. And oh my God, man, that breeds so many things, from egoism to narcissism to the idea that if anybody out there even attempts to come and try to ruin this idol or talk about this idol, I will cut ties with families. I will divorce my wife. I will stop talking to my in-laws. I will ruin someone's business if they attempt to, at least for a moment now, ruin my idol being me. Rumi says the mother of all idols, Rumi, the mother of all idols is the self. So now what that breeds is that we become envious. Wait a second, that idol looks like it's better than mine, right? We become somebody who's suspicious. Are they talking about me as an idol, me? What are you saying? No, I saw the way you're looking at me across the room. You guys were talking about me, what were you saying? And all of a sudden now, what isn't there is made up, and that causes all sorts of friction. He said, she said, it's not what I meant. No, you said this, you didn't do LOL afterwards, so you must have meant it. That LOL is everything. Haha, you looked horrible today, LOL. Oh, okay, it was a joke. Okay, good. What a horrible speech, I said, bye, LOL. Oh, okay, thanks. That LOL is great, isn't it? Yeah. All to preserve me. We break relationships, right? And we end up just being this person who's constant alert. Anyone here looking to break me as an idol? No? Okay. And then what happens? Anxiety, depression, mental health, BP going high, we become sick, all because it's just so hard to uphold this me inside of me. Because I was created to enslave myself. We have an innate nature to worship something higher than me that has to be outside of me. So, one of the biggest barriers we have in converting our ilm to amal and doing justice on those around us, from ourselves to our children, to our wives, to the people of Yemen, to the African American community, one of the biggest barriers is that we don't see the injustice. How can we, when every lens is turned inwards? It's turned inwards. In a God-centric society, we hear the breathing of others, we feel the pain of others, we see the suffering of others, we see the blood of others, we see the wounds of others. And after a while, when you hurt, I hurt. When you bleed, I bleed. When you smile, I smile. That's a God-centric society. And that's what I've been trying to achieve in myself for the past 3 nights, inside our own little cocoon of 4 or 5 people inside of our family. Hamdardi, as they say in Urdu, right? This idea of me feeling your empathy, as they say. That's why when you look at the mission of Imam Hussein as a God-centric mission, you know how many times he cried on the day of Ashura? Looking at the pain of his family and his ashab, and he would cry like it was, you know, Janabi Hur himself says that he just met my son. And he cried like he'd known him for years. That's a God-centric man who can't bardash an ounce of anyone else's pain. Can't. And the pain that has been felt on this shahadat for Imam Hussein. Tonight is the night of Abbas. And sometimes just a name alone is enough. This was the commander of his army. This was the ray of hope for the entire tent. No matter how bleak it looked, the way that history writes sometimes, they would look to Abbas and say, we have Abbas. Abul Fazl Abbas says, Mawla, give me ijazat. It's already been too long. And this is one of those musa'ibs that I find very difficult for myself to recite. This and Ali Asghar. I don't know what it is. I find it hard for me to recite this musa'ib. So I'm bound to miss some things tonight. And I apologize. It's enough to know that Abbas comes to Imam Hussein and says, Mawla, give me ijazah, give me permission to go fight. Imam Hussein will look at him and say, Abbas, you're my alamdar. You're the leader of my army. This was Abbas, a giant of a man, a warrior trained by Amir al-Mu'mineen, chosen for the day of Ashura, standing in front of Imam Hussein, Mawla, please, just give me ijazat. Abbas, you're my alamdar. Mawla, give me ijazat. Abbas, you're my alamdar. Mawla, give me ijazat. Give me ijazat. There comes a moment now, and the ashab are gone. Some of the Bani Hashim are gone. Mawla, give me ijazat. Imam Hussein says that same line, Abbas, you're my alamdar. You're the leader of this army. At that moment, the books say, Abbas looked around, says, Mawla, what army is left that I'm the alamdar of? Abbas, if you want to go, go and get water for the children. Abbas gets ready. Abul Fazl gets ready. Given his alam, he had the highest of the alams of all the alams that were given. Mashk of Sakina, his armor, his helmet, his alam. He rides into the Maidan of Karbala. The enemy parts. He ends up at the banks of Furat. Do we ever stop and wonder, every year I make this point, do you ever stop and wonder how? How did Abbas get to the banks of Furat? You have to go across a Maidan, an arena of war, where you're surrounded by thousands. Then go down a little bit of a slope at the banks of Furat, enough time to fill the Mashk of Sakina, enough time for a moment of contemplation, and go all the way back up that slope, enter again. Either that means that he fought his way to Furat, or it means that when they saw Abbas enter the Maidan of Karbala, they all backed away. This is Abbas. Fear would be triggered inside the hearts of the enemy. Abbas makes it to the banks of Furat, fills the Mashk of Sakina, and then that moment that breaks my heart. Some say that there was water inside the hands of Abbas, and had he taken a sip of water, nobody would have blamed him. He was also thirsty, his lips were parched. It's the same heat that's killing Abbas, the same sun that's shining down onto Abbas. He's been there since the second of Muharram. He was also thirsty, but this is Abbas. My salams to the wafadari of Abbas, your loyalty, hazar salam Abbas. On one ear he hears Al-Atash of Sakina. On one ear he sees the parched lips of Hussein. He drops the water, roars back into the Maidan of Karbala. Umar ibn Sa'd says, if that water gets back to Hussein, they surround the man. You can't fight him one-on-one. By this day of Ashura, the minimum amount of people that were in Umar bin Sa'd's army, as you know, were 30,000. And I have no reason to believe that he didn't dispatch as many as he could. So thousands now, thousands, I want you to picture that. Thousands are surrounding Abbas alone, Mashk of Sakina filled in one hand, Alam in the other. He begins to roar into the Maidan of, and back to the Khaymah of Imam Hussein. In the Khaymah, Bibi Sakina, gather the small kids, grab your kuzo, grab your cups. My Chacha Abbas has gone for water. My Chacha Abbas has gone for water. She's watching the alam. The alam is up. There's water coming. The alam is up. The water is coming. There's no way that my Chacha Abbas would go and not come back for water. Abbas now surrounded by the enemy. Whoever had rocks, threw rocks at Abbas. Whoever had a spear, threw the spear at Abbas. And then there comes a moment now where Ammalun ambushes Abbas from the back and what? And chops off his right arm. He grabs the alam and the mashk in his left arm. Then another Mal'un comes as he's roaring to his way back to the Khaymah and chops off his other arm. Abbas now, alam inside between his legs, mashk of Sakina inside of his mouth. It doesn't matter. He forgets the pain. Al-Atash, Al-Atash is all he remembers. I have to bring that water. Sakina watching the alam go down and go back up, go down and go back up. And then at that moment, Umar ibn Sa'd says, Hurmala, shower the man with arrows. A rain of arrows comes towards Abbas. One arrow hits the shoulder of Abbas, he takes it out. One arrow hits the thigh of Abbas, he takes it out. One arrow hits the neck of Abbas, he takes it out. Constantly moving towards the khaymah of Imam Hussein. I have to give water to my Aqa. I have to give water to my Sakina. But the one arrow that killed the man was the arrow that hit the mashk of Sakina. Water began to drain out. The mashk is empty. My Abbas now stops where he is. Look at the courage of Abbas. I don't have water for the khaymah. I don't have arms to defend myself against the enemy. What does he do? On one side, there are children waiting for him for water. On one side, an enemy waiting to kill him. My Abbas, the courageous Abbas, turns back around and roars back into the Maidan of Karbala, right in the heart of the enemy, somehow begins to defend himself. But there comes a moment now where Abbas falls from the horse. Assalamu alayka, ya Abba Abdullah. But when somebody falls from a horse from that high and that big of a man, they use their arms to break the fall. My Abbas didn't have arms to break that fall. He falls onto the zameen of Karbala. Imam Hussein hears the call, goes roaring into the Maidan of Karbala. Abbas, you were my Alamdar Abbas. You were my Alamdar Abbas. Mawla, I'm Sharminda. Please don't take my body back to the Khaymah. Imam Hussein grabs the alam, goes back to the Khaymah. Bibi Sakina comes out of the Khaymah. She sees the alam. She does not see the alamdar. Chacha Abbas, your Sakina is not thirsty anymore. Matame Hussein.